En podcast från Aftonbladet.
Karin, är du exalterad?
Det är fel ord, jag är supernervös.
Jag är faktiskt jävligt exalterad.
Är du det?
Ja, och så glad för att vi har verkligen fin besök i Café Bambino idag.
Men jag är också jätteglad, men jag är också nervös.
Ja, men såklart. Vem skulle inte vara det?
Eftersom vi ska träffa
Sadie
fucking
Smith.
Ja,
ja, hon kommer till Café Bambino idag för att prata om sin nya roman Bedragaren i översättning av... Håll i hatten så ska ni få höra vem den är översatt av. Niklas Nilsson, jättefin översättning.
Jättefin översättning, verkligen.
Men Sadie Smith debuterade ju år 2000 med Vita tänder som blev ju en mega succé.
Insane.
Jag minns att jag minns när jag läste den. Mm. Min mamma läste den och jag lånade den efter henne och jag var helt blown away av den här boken.
Ja.
Och sen så efter det kom hon med boken om skönhet.
Mm. Hon har skrivit massa essäer, men hon har skrivit många romaner däremellan.
Ja, jättemånga romaner, och hon skriver också i New Yorker. Och nu har hon då kommit med Bedragaren på svenska.
Mm.
Ska vi förklara vad den här boken handlar om?
Ja, jag tycker att vi ska förklara det så slipper hon göra det när hon kommer.
Exakt.
Det är också, det här är ju en bok... Det är en ganska,
den är ju lite komplicerad.
Den är ganska komplicerad. Den är ganska komplex. Ja. Det är en historisk roman som utspelar sig i 1800-talets London till stor del, också en del på Jamaica.
Mm.
Den behandlar två eller tre liksom,
för mig är det som att det är
bågar.
Två delar.
Ja, två delar.
Det är en om Eliza som heter Mrs. Touché, Eliza Touché, som blir änka och flyttar ihop med sin kusin som är manliga kusin som är en väldigt för sin tid hyllad författare och säljer mer än Charles Dickens at the time. Den här författaren, den här mannen William, är en väldigt dålig författare.
Det är en historisk, det är en person som har funnits.
Ja, exakt. Alla de här personerna har ju funnits som är i romanen. Han är en väldigt dålig författare, han skriver väldigt många böcker. Eliza flyttar in med honom och hans hustru. Mm. De har liksom lite mellan raderna ett slags leka-trä-förhållande.
Ja, det har de. Så det är ett litet tema i boken.
Det är ett litet tema i boken. De har också, Eliza och William har också en sexuell relation som bland annat... jag säger det här nu för jag kommer att fråga henne om det här sen. Det är inte en stor del av boken. Involverar ridspö och smisk.
Ja.
Och sen så är det då andra delen av boken som handlar om ett jättekänt rättsfall i England under 1860-talet.
Och då var det så att en väldigt förmögen arvtagare försvann, antogs vara död. Och efter ett antal år så dyker en man upp och säger, jag är den här arvtagaren. Och hans vittne är en svart man från Jamaica som är en för detta slav som har jobbat i den här familjen.
Eller jobbat, sänkt ribba för att jobba.
Ja, men han blev frigiven, ja, i alla fall. Mm. Men som har varit tjänare, slav och sen tjänare där. Och det här är ett historiskt rättsfall som... dominerade pressen under, det pågick i åratal. Mm. Och det som är intressant är att den här bedragaren då, han så uppenbart var inte den här arvtagaren.
Han är uppenbart en bedragare och en slaktare.
Ja.
Och han är så fet. Och
han pratar så... inte franska.
Nej, han kan ju ingenting av det här. Nej. Som aristokraterna. Nej. Ska kunna. Och ändå så vittnar Andrew Bogle, som är den här... Andrew Bogle?
Bogle, tror jag.
Andrew Bogle, som är den här då svarta mannen, till hans fördel. Även fast han förlorar pengar på det här.
Mm.
Och det här blir liksom ett jättestort fall i England. Och folk då, arbetarklassen, alla fattiga, blir på den här bedragarens sida.
Ja, och det skapar en... Ja, det är en väldigt spännande situation och vi kommer att prata om vad man kan jämföra den här situationen med i dagens liksom, politiska landskap.
Och Eliza då börjar med sin kusins nya hustru besöka de här rättegångsdagarna.
Hon blir väldigt intresserad och sen lär känna det här vittnet. Man kan väl säga att det är olika trådar som vävs samman i den här boken. Det handlar om, liksom, om London, det viktorianska London, det handlar om skrivande. Men framförallt kan man väl säga att det handlar om den här strukturen av förtryck och slaveri och liksom hur det är... bedragaren är också England som låtsas att man inte är ett land som har slaveri, men som är helt beroende av...
Man låtsas att man vet ingenting om
Man vet ingenting, Jamaica och man är så civiliserad. Och så är det en rikedom som bygger på våld och förtryck och slaveri.
Och det är också jätteviktigt att säga att Charles Dickens är med.
Ja, han är med.
Sadie Smith har ju skrivit en väldigt fin och rolig essä i New Yorker förra året, om man vill läsa, om hur hon under hela sitt skrivande liv har försökt undvika Charles Dickens, ja, för att han har influerat hennes karriär väldigt mycket. Och alla svår karriär gör hon ju, menar hon. Alltså alla som skriver all kultur och allt vi tar del av. Och att när hon då till sist återvänder till England från New York, där hon har bott i flera år och undervisat, så dök fucking Charles Dickens upp.
Hon kunde inte undvika honom.
Hon kunde inte undvika honom.
Vi kan länka till den sen.
Ja, exakt.
Ja, så det finns mycket att prata om, helt enkelt.
Det finns så mycket att prata om.
Vi tänker väl att vi ska hålla oss till den här boken i det här samtalet.
Ja, det här är ett boksamtal.
Det är ett boksamtal. Mm. Och,
jag vill också säga en sak. Jag kommer inte fråga Sadie Smith någon fuck, marry, kill-fråga.
Nej, det tycker jag är rätt. Alltså, Sadie Smith. Nej, men
det är för... Alltså, det är för...
Nej.
Jag liksom...
Vi sparar det till nästa gäst.
Vi får spara det till nästa gäst.
Ja.
Okej,
okay. Okay, nu tror jag att hon snart är här.
TikTok, TikTok. Gå och hämta henne. Sadie, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's dive right into this marvelous novel you've written. I was so intrigued by getting a historical novel from you, and I'm a novelist myself, and I always think I got the novel when I get the voice for the novel. It can be the character, but it can also be the form or just the rhythm of the novel. And I thought about, how do you go about finding that voice when you're writing a historical novel, right? Since I think you have to have a language that's something somewhat for today, but also communicates with the time we're writing about.
I had a friend called Adam Thirlwell. He's an English writer who is also writing a novel set in the 18th century in Paris around the same time. And we're both, I would say, contemporary novelists and committed to the contemporary. So I think we both were wondering about that, and we came to different solutions. Adams is very funny, so he, you know, there's an element of absurdity of writing about France, but you're writing in English, so he assumed already that there's a translation involved. So he just used a voice which sounds exactly like it, as if you were reading, I don't know, Sally Rooney, or so the letters that are passed between 18th century Parisians are described as messages. So when you read it, it sounds like email, you know, the messages are being passed and forth, and there's parties every day. And so my attitude is the same, that I'm not interested in a Victorian voice. I think he was interested in what appears to be anachronism, but is actually the facts. Messages are passed in Paris 100 times a day, and people are having endless parties and taking drugs and all the rest of it, so it sounds contemporary. With me, I wanted to make sure... To me, it's just my voice. Like, I tried to avoid obvious anachronisms, but there's nothing particularly Victorian. I think people forget what Victorian novels sound like. If you pick up an actual Victorian novel, it doesn't sound anything like The Fraud. Yeah.
No, so, no, it really doesn't.
So to me, it's just my voice, short chapters, which is my choice, and it just happens to be about the 19th century, but it's not in the form of the 19th century.
I love the short chapters as well, and I thought it was a really beautiful way of telling the story.
Yeah, I that was just another kind of bit of resistance. I needed to make it, to give it a contemporary form, a form that interested me, rather than, you know, Victorian novels are 100 really long chapters, you know, 20, 30 page chapters, very dense, a lot of punctuation, a lot of heaviness, and I wanted mine to be light.
Yeah, and I love how you used the intertextuality as well in the novel. Right. It was really beautiful.
Yeah, and I mean, all novels these days are affected by film, by the internet, by the way that people put information together. So I that's a way of being a reader again, is allowing readers to read, to be active instead of just passive. Yeah.
So we have been thinking and discussing your characters in the book a lot in preparation for this conversation, and Obviously, the narrator or the main, the protagonist, Eliza, Mrs. Touche.
Yeah.
She's a character in a way from the periphery. She works. She's a cousin of and works in the household of this famous writer, and who's a historical figure,
right.
And they both are. How did you find her, and why is she the one telling the story?
I mean, in this case, it's more like a haunting because I really didn't, as far as I remember, in all the reading I did up to the book, which is about 12 years worth of reading, really, I had absolutely no intention of writing a book about Mrs. Touche. So it's hard to explain. That was not my intention. I knew it wasn't going to be in the first person, the novel. So I opened with the scene of a boy coming to the house. Mrs. Touche is in the doorway. And my memory of it is I wrote the first chapter and realised that it seems to be largely from her perspective. And the second chapter was the same and the third. And I just thought, okay, that's kind of how I worked. And the older I've got, the more I have given space to the subconscious. That's the best way I can put it. It's obvious to me that I thought I was very interested in writing about Harrison Ainsworth, but I guess I wasn't. And I just kind of allow for those things to happen while I'm writing.
No, it's like the novel takes the back door in to this big trial and case that's almost the heart of the novel.
I knew consciously, the bit which isn't subconscious, I wanted to try and demonstrate the actual way people were thinking at the time. I think it's very tempting to think, at times of terrible injustice, like slavery, that every person's mind is on it, that every newspaper is full of it. It's just not true. And, I mean, right now, you would think, I'm sure 100 years from now, you would think that every single news story on the front of the New York Times would be about Israel, Gaza, or the Sudan. But there was, for example, a big story today about how to pluck your eyebrows. Mm-hmm. There was a story about Kacey Musgrove's album. There's a story about how you should set your table if you're having brunch. This is the reality.
Mm.
So this is how people behave during times of terrible injustice. We do it ourselves all the time. So I wanted a novel that that created that structure. Of course, for Andrew Bogle, who's living in hell, that's an everyday existence. Mm. But for everybody else, they're just getting on with their day, which is what people do.
Mm. So we have this big court case, this trial that Tone says is at the heart of the novel, and so that's one storyline, and that coincides with the story of Mrs. Touche. She ends up there as a witness, as somebody who's reacting or dealing with that story, and then Andrew Bogle, who's the ex-slave he's from Jamaica, and he's a witness, he's the main witness in this trial.
Yeah.
And all these stories coincide. And I was wondering about the research. We were talking about your research.
Right.
Did it start with one of these stories?
I know, it's quite hard for me to reconstruct. Yeah. I went through my email to try and work it out, because people keep asking me this question.
Sorry.
And I don't know the answer. I think I knew about the Tichborne case first because there's a Borges story about it. It's about 3 pages long. It's in History of Infamy. I would have read it in college. And I think the reason I would have focused on it is because of the name Bogle. Bogle is an important name in Jamaica. We have a national hero called Paul Bogle, who's on Jamaican money. So I probably, back in those days, I was very, if I saw anything that was about Jamaica or about black people in general, I was very, you didn't get to see a lot of it. You're very kind of focused on it. So that's probably what happened there. At some point, I must have found out that the claimant, Tichborne, is buried next to my house because it was mentioned in NW. Mm. I don't know when I found that out or how, but I did. And then William, I was just aware for a long time, for at least the past 20 years, that there was this extremely famous novelist who lived around the corner from me who was completely out of print. And I just think it amused me, that idea, because it's, always possible. I'm sure I'll be out of print 10 years after I'm dead. It happens to people all the time. It's happening to Saul Bellow right now. So it just happens. It's one of those things. And I thought it was funny that people are so focused on their literary careers, so focused on their legacies and so unaware that these legacies are just destroyed. Most people are not remembered in literature. 99% of literature just goes on the bonfire every 50 years. So that I always thought was a funny idea. And then it just happened when I was reading about William that I saw this name, Keneally, and thought, well, I know that name. Why do I know that name? And Keneally was a young man, an Irish poet, around William's table, who 20 years later became a lawyer on this case. So,
such a small world.
It's a small world. So on the one hand, it's a coincidence, which is irresistible to novelists. Of course, readers have no reason to be interested in such a coincidence. I'm forcing it upon them. But it also is a larger point about 19th century London, which is it is a very small world. And that was Dickens' interest and point too, that all these overlapping worlds, he was in all of them. You know, the literary world, the world of work, the world of lawyers, the world of politics, the world of actors. A lot of these prominent Londoners were involved in all these things. So it's not actually that big a coincidence, because that kind of overlapping happened all the time. And of course, the other ethical point about that kind of overlapping is that then that suggests to me that this lie that England tells itself, that there was this terrible world in Jamaica and then we knew nothing about it, is also not true. Mm-hmm. Because the more you look into Victorian life, you see how profoundly foundational it was to London's wealth, to London's life. So it's all part of the same argument to me, that these are not two different worlds. This is one world, and I wanted to write about all of it.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And Dickens, of course, is a character in your in your book, and you kill him off.
Well, I didn't kill him. I mean, he died. That wasn't really anything to do with me. But, you know, I love Dickens, and I was interested in him as a person too. But, you know, whatever you think of him, he is a novelist, pure and all the way down to his core. So anything that I dislike about Dickens, I also dislike about myself, because he is absolutely one of my people.
I loved reading your Dickens essay in The New Yorker.
Yeah.
Because there you also mention, like, my one relationship to Dickens, which is the Muppet movie.
I'm a Dickens reader, but you watched the Muppet movie.
Your relation to Dickens is so much more extensive than you imagine. Because the whole romantic comedy industry in America wouldn't exist without Dickens. Many things wouldn't exist without Dickens. So he really is part...
everywhere.
If you grew up in any way in Anglophone culture, then you are participating in Dickens, yeah.
So not only the Muppets?
Not only the Muppets, no. All Christmas carols.
Do you have, like, another sense of responsibility when you write a historical novel? Or how did you feel during your process? Did you feel free from their...
No, the only responsibilities I felt were to Eliza and Andrew. The rest of them can perfectly well take care of themselves and have written reams and reams of books about each other and about themselves and letters. And so I didn't worry about Dickens or anything else. Dickens is impervious to anything from me or anyone else. But Eliza I did think about, because I'm now the only version of her. So, I mean, there are some things which just are annoying. Like, I found out only recently that in 2021 there was an auction of material from William's house, letters and bits and bobs. I think it sold for about £1,000. I would happily have paid it. And in there was a drawing of Eliza. But I don't know. I can't find it. The person who bought it won't communicate with me. It's such a shame. So I would love to see her. That's impossible. There is a drawing of her and her sisters, and maybe someone will one day show it to me, but I haven't seen it. But so it's that not quite knowing the face that I'm talking about. I know where she's buried. I know this and that. And I know her from her appearance in William's novels, because she does appear over and over, really, in these kind of strange forms. Mm. So I felt something towards her because I really loved, it's my favourite character I think I've ever written, is Eliza, and so that there was that. And Andrew, because he's, whether I like it or not, he's representing 400 years worth of struggle. Mm. And slavery. So I wanted to be as accurate as I could be in his case.
Why is she your favorite character?
Because she's the most real. That's all that matters to a novelist. Mm. How successful it is as a character.
Yeah.
To me, she could walk into the room and I would know her exactly. So there's very few of my characters I feel that way about. Mm. So maybe Fatu in Embassy of Cambodia. Mm. So that's why. She's just the most successful in my view.
Mm. I think she really also made a time come alive for me, because I think it was just like, we talked about it when we first read the novel, both of us, that like that we had this feeling that like human life was the same almost.
Yeah.
There's such a connection to this time, and you want to think it's like so long ago and everything's changed so much,
but it's the same.
Yeah.
I think that, I mean, that was part of the reason I wrote it, because I was really aware talking to younger people that their version of this period was really very flat and very banal, and also that they were missing an opportunity, because one of the things I learned about the 19th century, which I didn't know to this extent, is the level of mass activism. Mm. And I've really felt that my students, by believing that the 19th century was this like tragic, fixed place where nothing was good and nothing, you're missing the opportunity to learn. Mm. Like, if you're interested, how do enormous, unjust systems end? Mm. You really should be looking at the 19th century, because they managed it way more than we have.
Yeah.
They managed it.
Yeah.
So that's worth thinking about. How do you end? I mean, it's hard to exaggerate how profitable plantation slavery was. Mm. Like, they're making money, not as profitable as the men in Palo Alto right now, but close. Mm. They're making world-breaking amounts of money. How do you stop a system like that?
Mm. So you've been writing about how you've been skeptical before about writing a historical novel. And I was thinking the idea of some idealized past or of history often serve conservative interest, because it's the winners mostly who write history.
Right.
Is that... Number one, is that why you were skeptical writing a historical novel?
I think both versions, that conservative version and the leftist version, I mean, the banal version of the leftist version, which is the past is a tragic place, we are the perfect improvement upon it. Both of them are ignorant, extremely ignorant, and they know it means that you don't actually understand the lessons of history. So when someone says to me in a self-satisfied way, oh, it just proved to me nothing ever changes, women never get... No, that's not what it proves. What the 19th century demonstrates to the 21st century is that this moment is really like the Victorian period. Why? Because economic inequality is at a peak, because there are a series of robber barons running the world. So you're right, it's the same now. But if you ask me, is 1867 like 1952? No. Mm. 1952 is a moment of great progress, of a welfare state, of public schools, meaning state schools, of decent housing. That's a revolutionary moment. What we have now is a Victorian moment, but why?
Mm.
It's not that history goes like that. That argument, which the left thinks is a progressive argument, is a conservative argument.
Mm.
Yeah. It suggests that things just go in one direction and you don't have to worry about it. That's not true.
Now, reading this book, it made me think of maybe more Walter Benjamin's view of
that
history.
That is a much more accurate view of history,
So, like, opening up the past, remembering past struggles, like really remembering maybe revolutionary moments.
Right, and taking what you can use.
Yeah.
Like, to me, to go back to 19th century is to realise, oh, wait a minute, there was a mass working class movement of solidarity with what was going on in plantation slavery. That's remarkable. So what does that tell you? What can be achieved?
Mm.
It's not that Lancashire cotton workers thought that they were the same as Jamaican slaves, but they understood that they were working under the same system. That's a really important realization, that we don't have to be the same to act in solidarity with each other.
I think a way the novel opened up this understanding for me was both in how you portray that and the struggle, but also like in the portrayal of sex and how you organize relationships that felt very modern and accurate for today.
I mean, I think it's really important for us to realise every generation genuinely, I'm now 48, so I've seen it happen, believes that they have invented sex. It's like a miraculous thing.
I feel you.
It's so comic. Every single time they're like... I think my generation thought...
Listen to this, Tune.
We thought we'd invented anal sex, right?
Yeah.
That was mine in the 90s. We were like, have you ever heard? Yes, of course, everybody's heard. They were having anal sex in 1312. Mm. Nothing changes in the realm of sex, nothing. Mm. All that changes is language and the law, but not the actual action.
No.
And as for polyamory and all the rest of it, it's really hard to find a Victorian marriage with only two people in it. You're under illusion if you think you're making sexual revolutions. You are never making a sexual revolution. You may be making a representational revolution. You may be able to speak about it more. Mm. You may decriminalize it or bring it to the attention of the law. But nothing you do in a bedroom is new. Never. Mm. That is an illusion.
So in the book, Mrs. Touche or Eliza, the protagonist, she is having a relationship with the wife of her cousin.
Yeah.
And then she's having a very... Sounds like a great relationship, sexual relationship with her cousin.
Yeah.
And she's very content. I think it's unproblematic. It's just something, a joy in her,
right.
in her life. But what she doesn't have for it is a language, I guess.
She doesn't have a language. And I think that question, I'm ambivalent about. Like, it's absolutely the case that without a language, you can have no rights. It's at the same point, without a language, you're not legislated against.
Mm.
So it's a double-edged sword. And that was Foucault's point, right? Like, you can have this language, but be aware the moment you have the language, you're in the legal system.
Mm.
And there are good and bad things to being in the legal system. And I think if you listen to, like, my generation of gay men, for example, there's sometimes a nostalgia for being outside of the law.
Mm.
And that can be hard to understand, but the point is, when you're outside of the law, you're outside of the law. Mm. There are also advantages to it. And of course, there are advantages to being within the law. You get to be married, you get to have property rights, you get to have your children as your own children. There's no doubt there are also advantages, but it's not an unalloyed good. It's complicated, I think.
Because I was wondering, it's the question of the law and the structures and language, but it also seems to me, reading about her, that the lack of language also maybe makes her more free in her own mind.
I mean, that's what I thought. I thought, obviously, she doesn't have the rights I have. And if I was asked to swap with Mrs. Touche...
And she's very privileged.
I definitely wouldn't do it as a black woman, if I was a white woman.
Yeah.
But looking at her thoughts, I thought, compared to your average 35-year-old girl who wakes up in the morning and her thoughts are dominated by what she is told to think about, by a device in her hand... which is monetized by people who are also exploiting her economically at every moment. I don't know. I really don't know, actually. Mrs. Touche wakes up every day and she thinks whatever the hell she wants to think about, whatever she's interested in, whatever concern says. She is not bullied out of her thoughts. She's not told what to think, how to think, in what language to think it. So she has a great deal of mental freedom, which, to be honest, I do envy, looking back.
Mm.
For me, it was also really interesting reading about the fraud or a fraud in a time like this. Because in the novel, I mean, the trial is the claimant says he's aristocratic,
right?
But he's believed to be a butcher, and there's a big trial, and the people is like on his side.
Mm.
And for me, it was just such an interesting time to write a novel like this because, I mean, the fraud is such a prevalent
Right. But figure. Why? Again, it's a structural thing. Every time people write about it, they write it as if there's something wrong with millennials, there's something immoral about them. There's nothing immoral about them. If you can't find a way to progress within a society economically, fraud becomes a pretty fair response to the situation.
Yeah, because I thought about it because now I think the fraud is almost like hold like this truth savior.
Yeah.
Or like speaking truth to power.
It's just a way of getting
ahead. It's like a paradox, isn't it?
I think that's what all those fraudsters from Friedman to Elizabeth Thanatos women and all of them, that all happened while I was writing. And I couldn't have predicted any of those things. But when you look at the actual economic situation in 1867 and now, it makes perfect sense.
Mm.
You have a very small percentage of people who are very, very rich. You have a lot of people hustling. Victorian London is full of hustlers, people just doing 1,000 gigs just to make enough money to live.
Mm.
It starts to look very, very familiar. And then when you see a court system like England had, which was profoundly unfair, it doesn't surprise me that a fraudster goes through it. Just as when you see a kind of economic system like we have now, which is profoundly unfair, that people will do anything to try and make their way through it.
And I mean, there's really like this big obsession in pop culture around frauds as well.
Yeah.
That I think is really,
There's no admiration for them. I think even when people look at Thanatos, they think, yeah, but she made a lot of money in a short time. Mm. Good for her. Yes. That's literally what they think.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is, it's symptomatic of the economic system we're in, whereas if you grew up in the 70s and 80s, those kind of frauds, that felt outrageous, you know. But we're in a completely different situation, not in a perfect situation, but one in which some movement was possible.
Mm.
And some of the promises that were made to you as a working class kid in that system were actually possible. Now they are fraudulent claims. They don't exist.
So what happens is that we have this big trial, and then the claimant is trying to present himself as the heir of this big fortune, and his witness then is Andrew Bogle that we mentioned before. And he's backed up by him. He's a black man, an ex-slave from Jamaica, and his story is told in detail at the center of the book, at the core, at the heart of the book, you could say. And he's, apart from Mrs. Touché, the most important character. Can you talk about him a bit and who
I think
what he
I
represents?
Wanted to... There's a great scene in that movie, Get Out, where Daniel Kaluuya falls through the floor. And I thought, I quite wanted the book to have that type of structure, that because that's how England was. Like, if you turn up in London in 1867, everything, if you squint and you don't look in the dark corners, everything looks very pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of building going on, a lot of wealth, a lot of lovely tea parties, a lot of nice dinners, a lot of industry. It looks great as long as you don't look in certain corners. And so I wanted to construct the book that way, that you feel like you're reading a very comic or pleasant English novel until you're not.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically how I wanted it to feel. So
because it takes on a different form. Almost.
Yeah,
it's just it's this novel is first this one novel that becomes this other novel.
And it's hard to because it's in bad taste, right? The idea is you shouldn't have something as serious as slavery alongside writers gossiping about literature. Mm. But the painful truth is these things happen simultaneously.
Mm.
They happen simultaneously. People are on the streets dying in Haiti right now, and I'm in a book podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how the world works. So I felt like I wanted to demonstrate that. And also the relation that writers have to these kind of situations are tenuous at best. There have always been people signing petitions. There have always been people boycotting. That's always gone on in literary London. And it's always been mostly useless.
Hmm.
So I wanted to demonstrate that too, that writers have some role to play, but it's usually overstated.
Hmm.
And that the only thing that ends situations like Andrew Bogle's is mass action on the part of the people. Writers can sometimes nudge ideas one way or another and create conversations, but any idea that they have that they are the prime movers in these situations is delusional.
Eliza has a really funny line in the book where she hurts the writers. That's like, oh, he's a writer, who cares about what he says or something.
Yeah,
like
I think Dickens is a good example. Like, as far as actual change goes, I don't think there is any writer, and I include Audre Lorde or whoever you want to list, who's made more actual change than Dickens.
Mm-hmm.
He changed the law. He took children out of labour. He changed the law. And yet Dickens, when asked about Jamaica, was like, ugh.
Yeah.
So if you rely on writers for this kind of ethical clarity, you'll get some, but mostly not.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be disappointed a lot.
Mm.
Whereas, as far as I can see, looking at English history, the only time things really change is people power at a mass level, which puts pressure on Parliament and changes the actual law. The most radical thing you can do as a young person is not to become a novelist, in my view, become an international lawyer.
Or a climate activist.
That is a job, yeah. Or a climate activist. Or an international lawyer in climate. That, yeah. That's ideal.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, I was thinking about Eliza, Mrs. Touché, when we're talking about change and solidarity, because she's such a complex, interesting figure. I mean, she comes from this privileged position in society, and she's trying to... she's an abolitionist, she's a Catholic, so
yeah.
she has a conscience, or she works with herself, and she's trying to be solidaric. But in the end... She's also sentimentalist, and she has her limits very clearly where solidarity ends. But at the same time, I'm struggling with her as a character.
But that's what I want readers to... That's the job of a reader. Like, your decision is, well, where does Mrs. Touché lie? I read, when I was reading this book, I was reading a lot of histories of the 19th century, but from different times. So I could read one written in the 20s, in the 40s, in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s. Each one has a different cast, a different emphasis, a different interest. When you get to the ones written in the 2020s, there is a lot of these sweeping statements of, you know, all the abolitionists were useless, wannabe Karens. It's like, well, I understand that Mrs. Touché is not Frederick Douglass. And any grown adult with an ethical sense can make a difference between Frederick Douglass and Mrs. Touché. But the idea that small players in mass movements are worthless is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. That is a ridiculous argument. And so trying to understand that you can make ethical difference, if you feel the need to, if it's important to you to say, here is the greatest moral actor, here is the second one, here is the third, be my guest. I don't actually find that a very useful habit, but if you want to do that, that's fine. But the idea that there is only perfect action and then nothing, if you believe that, then I don't know how you think... vested interests I have ever defeated. Because in the case of plantation slavery, that required the slaves themselves primarily revolting every few years, consistently burning down plantations, killing owners. That had to radical action. It wasn't enough by itself. Then you needed the nice ladies who didn't want sugar in their tea. Then you needed the activist ladies who actually went to meetings. Then you needed the working class people in Manchester, in all over Lancaster, in Liverpool, in London. And then finally, you needed the petitions of the public and the politicians. So that's the reality. So you, in an environmental analogy, you can say, Greta, you just do this. Just you do it, Greta.
Or, good luck.
Yeah, good luck with that. Or you can admit that even the person who gets on a plane to Paris in the summer might still play a role. The climate activist has a role. The kids throwing paint at the Mona Lisa have a role. Everybody has a role, but it's going to take many people.
But it has
and some
fraud.
Of those people are not going to be perfect actors.
What is the role of the fraud then in that?
Well, I think that's a more obscene thing that happens every now and then. The example I keep talking about, because it's the one that seems to me closest, is not Trump, actually, but OJ.
That's what I thought when I read the book, yeah.
Nobody, and I'm a socialist and I think I'm rational, I don't want American courts to change because a man who killed his wife is let off free. Mm. That is not my ideal. But given, you know, 150 years of racist American courts, it took something obscene passing through them to create a change at the level of the jury. So that case broke apart the idea that all white juries should sit in judgment on black subjects, which had been going on for a very long time. But so it's not a rational kind of politics. It's populist, but every now and then it works.
But it's we were also talking about mass action, and in a way, the way this trial is supported or covered or
that's
the energy
it's a kind of mass
it's
action.
A kind of mass
it's a theater
action. It's a theater, but it also puts pressure on the
and
system.
The other example is the McDonald's trial in England in the 90s, where two it was very famous in England, maybe didn't reach here, but two very nerdy a couple raincoats glasses who objected to McDonald's use of beef, the way they use beef, the way they cut down the Amazon rainforest, all of which was pretty much unknown in England in the late 80s and 90s, took McDonald's on with their little notes, with no money. And it was such a furore, and they just persisted. They didn't win, but it was the longest case after Tichborne. Tichborne was the longest case until their case.
Mm.
So it kept McDonald's in the news for almost 2.5 years. And it didn't break McDonald's, but there's no one on earth now who doesn't know that McDonald's is a corrupt business, environmentally destructive business, and terrible for your health, which was all the points that these two people wanted to make. So I think theatre is included in those kind of court cases, and it can be transformative. But, of course, you don't want democracies to improve by the way of spectacle. That's not anybody's first choice. But sometimes there's no other way.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Just made me think so much about, first, it made me remember the O.J. Simpson case, which I'm a bit older than you, and just for our younger audience, yeah. That was a very big, maybe one of the biggest news stories of the 90s,
yeah.
Where this famous black NFL player was accused of killing his wife. And the
and
evidence was very...
And vicious murder.
Yes,
yeah.
Vicious murder. And the evidence was so strong. It was.
I mean, he literally went from the scene covered in blood, driving a white Bronco
And
this, down the street.
And it was in L.A. And
it was insane.
And which is notoriously racist police force. And the black jury, majority black jury, acquitted him.
Yeah. And the kind of twist of it was, it's the same as Tichborne, is that what I couldn't understand, I found that case very, very distressing because I was English.
Yeah.
And I couldn't understand it. But OJ was a white black man in the same way that Tichborne is a rich poor man or a poor rich man, because effectively, structurally, OJ was white because he was rich.
Yeah.
And that's what that case was really about. But from my perspective as a black Brit and young, I was, you know, just coming out of college. To me, it was a man who murdered his wife. End of story.
Yeah.
I was a feminist and I could not comprehend what my... American cousins were celebrating, you know. I could not understand it. But 15 years in America, I understood it. Mm-hmm. That's the best way to put it.
Mm.
So to me, these things are monstrous, but I think it's very easy for the left to find right-wing populism monstrous. But when you look at left-wing populism, which I think is what OJ represents, you see where people are attracted to it.
Mm.
You see the function of it and you see how it works. When other things don't.
But in my mind, you write about this trial and the case and the people who support the claimant with great tenderness. And you really, I mean, it's a reaction against the way I read that what you write is that it is a clear reaction against the system of oppression at the core of it.
Yeah, and I think that's the other thing that I was trying to... Again, thinking about my younger readers, make them understand that in England, I come from two lines of oppressed people, enslaved Jamaicans and working class white people.
Right.
Who in England were criminalized for existing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you stole some sugar, you could be hung. If you stole a sheep, you could be hung or sent to Australia. On and on and on this went. And by the 19th century, we've come to the mild version of it in the 16th century, 17th century, you could be hung, drawn, quartered, your guts dragged through town. These are not just fictional. This was,
that's insane.
That's
actually
literally what happened.
Yeah. Mm.
People gathering in the centre of London weekly to watch people tortured. So the history of oppression, I guess, is long and there's plenty to go around, is what
right.
I mean. There's really no corner of society that hasn't experienced this, all on different timescales. But I just wanted to try and complicate that history and to make evident that the constant is not race, because race is a fairly recent invention. It comes with slavery. It is its baby. But the constant is power. Money and power.
Sure.
That you will see from the beginning of time. And whoever is subject to money and power changes in different countries and different moments. But money is always rules. So one of the I guess from a socialist point of view, that is where your attention should be. Hmm. Who has power and who has money?
Yeah, I think it was interesting also reading, because the fraud takes on great many shapes in this novel. But I mean, there's also the question of like England being the fraud, or the English wealth, or what it's built on, and trying to...
I mean, I think a large part of English history is fraudulent, but I don't... Again, to me, that's not... it doesn't make me hate England, or there is no nation state in this world that isn't built on a fiction. They are fictional constructions. Mm. That's what they are. Mm. So the question is, how close does the fiction resemble what actually happened? And in certain countries, the gap is very large. And when it comes to the land grab of the 19th century in Africa and India on the part of all European countries, the gap is large. Yeah, it is a kind of... inability to comprehend what happened. And then, of course, a further inability to comprehend the consequences of what happens when you do that for 100 years. Mm, yeah. And then are amazed when the people from these countries turn up on your doorstep 100 years later. So it's a series of inabilities to understand or refusals to understand. But it's not... I never feel despair, because the facts are everywhere to be read. You just go to libraries, pick up books. It's not hard. They're not secret. Nothing's hidden. You can go and get it. Mm.
But do you think, maybe it's a banal question, I don't know, but I was thinking about, I mean, reading your book and thinking about these moments of, revolutionary moments, or moments of protest, moments of conflict, moments of violence, and that we don't... so much of history that we miss out from a left, I guess, from a left perspective. But do you think that also closes the future? Does that do something?
No,
that pacifize us, or is that too instrumental?
I'm optimistic, but I think I'm also. I don't know. I care not about ideology, but about history. And when you look at history, the painful fact, I think, though maybe not painful for strict Marxists, but painful for me, is that when change really happens, is after complete breakdown.
Yeah,
that the most revolutionary states we've ever had happen in the ruins of 1945. That's just a fact. And I understand. I mean, sometimes I talk to young people who call me a liberal, or call the whole of the late 20th century just liberalism. Mm-hmm. But I would be fascinated to know what society in the history of the world is more equitable than what we cobbled together across Western Europe in the ruins of the war. I'd just be interested. Mm. Where is there a society where there is free education, decent housing, and free medical care? Where did that happen before in human history? Mm. I'm not saying it's the perfect thing that can happen, but it's as close as we have at the moment come, and it is now being destroyed all across Europe, in my country and yours. That seems to me something worth fighting for. Mm. And it often seems to me that the people who are most dismissive of it, in my experience, are people who have no experience of it, who went to private schools, who were raised with money, and have no conception of what the commons is or what it means to people. Mm. So I find it tiring to talk to those people who think there's no difference between Whiggism and 20th century socialism. There is a difference. Mm. I lived it.
Maybe that also goes to your argument about coalitions and possible coalitions and how to construct... I mean, you have this example in your book with the Manchester cotton workers who are boycotting cotton produced by slave.
Yeah.
And even though they are losing from that on that economically, but... still, that's an act of solidarity and trying to do something with the economic structures.
I mean, I grew up in northwest London, and there's a famous in our neighbourhood strike that happened in the McVitie's factory. The McVitie's make biscuits in England, and everybody who worked there was Indian, mostly Indian women, mostly recent immigrants, a lot of them from Kenya, so Asian Africans or Indians themselves. And they went on strike. And one of the striking things about that strike, which I think is 1982, is that postal workers, white English postal workers from the neighbourhood, joined them, and also dinner ladies from all our schools. And that I've never forgotten. I was 7, 8 when that happened. And looking at them in the street, these were working people who, you know, if you went into your average white male postal worker's house and asked him what he thought about Hindu women, I'm sure you wouldn't have heard the most flattering. But it didn't matter because they were working there together. And I also, I suppose, am of the extreme view that people's personal feelings about me as a black woman, what they think about me or my hair, or my, I actually don't care. I don't care. I understand people care about these things. I personally don't give a shit. I don't care what you think of me as a human or whether you... It's your personal views of me are not relevant. All that's relevant to me are political structures that make the lives of me and my family and the people I know in my community reasonable and just. What you think in your personal little sad racist heart in your house is your business. Mm. The other argument is a kind of Christian argument that I need to know what's in your soul. Let me see your soul is pure. I'm not that kind of Christian. All I care about is effective politics and effective action. So in an ideally just society, what your neighbour thinks of you doesn't actually matter. Mm. I'm not marrying my neighbour. Mm. I don't care about what my neighbour thinks about me. I care about my friends, my family, my community, my people. As long as my neighbour understands that I have absolute same right to an education, healthcare and housing as him, I'm good. Of course, it's ideal if he also understands that I am a human being. Yeah. As well. That's lovely if it happens, but it's not necessary to a just society. It's just icing on the cake.
Mm-hmm. So, maybe that's also... I was thinking about... We were talking before this conversation about the scene with Eliza and Andrew,
He tells her his life story.
Yeah.
And she's shocked and she says, like, what can you know of another person? Eliza's
sentimental and that's really interesting to me. Sometimes reading the views that people think that I am Eliza or I agree. I'm trying to depict a sensibility which is about, you know, if I know Andrew, if I love him but Andrew and Henry, their argument is, I don't care if you love me. I don't need to know you. We don't need to be friends. You don't need to understand what it's like to be black. I don't really care what it's like to be you. I just want justice. Mm. And so to me, the politics of sentimentality, I understand lots of black people feel differently, but I don't care if you touch my hair. I don't care. I don't care about any of those things. Mm. They're not relevant to me. My ego is not so fragile that what you think about my hair and my body breaks me into pieces. I'm not concerned.
I think it was an interesting way of reading when I read about Eliza and Andrew in the novel, that it's also like empathy as empathy is not a good ground for solidarity.
No, it's lovely to have between lovers and friends and family, but it's not necessary for political solidarity.
And it also has its limits.
It has its limits
on empathy.
And I also, I think I find it personally humiliating, which I know might be just my thing. You know, those arguments about cultural appropriation, and I immediately noticed that nobody ever accused me of culturally appropriating Howard, for example, the white man in On Beauty. And I thought, why? And I realized, they think Howard is impervious. Mm. I can do anything to Howard because Howard's fine. He just goes through the world and I can joke about him and ridicule him and he's not in any danger. So I guess what I'm saying is I believe myself to be and aspire to be that subject. I am not in any danger from you, from your thoughts about me, or you can't hurt me. Hmm. So that's something I was raised with, which is a pride in myself and a pride in the colour of my skin and the person I am. So I cannot participate in arguments which make me some delicate subject of somebody else's opinion.
I was just wondering, just going back to earlier in the conversation, we talked about Dickens, and you said he was a writer who actually instigated a lot of social change with his writing, but he was a great sentimentalist. I mean, was
enormously, and sometimes it's useful, right?
Yeah.
You have to say to people in Victorian London genuinely did not believe that working class children were anything.
Yeah.
They just didn't think they were anything. They were like rats in the street. Hmm. So it took someone saying, look at little Nell, she's dying.
Yeah.
For them to give a shit. And that is also one of the purposes of movies and sentimental novels. And I don't think that's at all nothing. I think it's really important. And I am absolutely aware that when I think about novels, by wonderful novels like Bud of Suburbia, it's not a sentimental novel, but it certainly does the job of alerting people, like, look, we're here, we're human, we're funny, we have ideas. That is not nothing. And when I wrote White Teeth, I absolutely, that was part of my intention. But it's not the only thing that writing can do.
And those emotions are so short. I mean, normally they're just this. You're lit, and then the fire goes away, and then that's not the problem.
They can come and go.
It's not a structure.
But I do think when you look at particularly gay rights, as we used to call them, I don't think the progress would have been made in America without the movies, without television, those things that are now kind of. We have contempt for, like Will and Grace or Gay Best Friends, or but the fact is, they did something. They changed people's minds at a really fundamental emotional level. So it makes me a little bit sad when, you know, we move on from them and heap contempt on these people. I feel the same when I think about black actors in old Hollywood. Like I always was aware. Well, my mother always taught me. Don't have contempt for those people. Don't have contempt for Stephen Fetchit or Hattie McDaniels, or because there was nothing and then there was them and they did what they had to do.
I think I got a really good writer's lesson from the bad writer in the novel, William Eliza
Scott. Oh, yeah.
He's so relaxed. He's like really like, she's like, but he's writing a novel about Jamaica. He's like, but what do you know about Jamaica? He's like, but what do I know about anything?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, William was a little too relaxed.
Yes,
and that is
I
a
mean,
problem.
That was so, and he was just writing bad novel after bad novel just to fill the void of the badness almost. Yeah.
So, you know, I think in all those arguments about good writing and authenticity, obviously you have to make effort. You need to know something. You need to know something. Sometimes it's personal experience, sometimes it's research. But the kind of blithe ignorance of William will not work. No, it won't work.
I just have to ask, how was it like reading all of his novels?
Oh, I mean, I didn't. I couldn't. there's so many.
I was like, did she read all of them?
Not even Eliza read them.
I think there's... Yeah. No, I didn't. No. 45 or 46 of these books, maybe more... The first one is not bad and has a lot of energy, but they are diminishing returns. But I do think about William, which I really admire and which I am not like this at all, is that he was a very wonderful member of the literary community. Mm-hmm. And I still know writers like that who participate and they go to meetings and they organise dinners and they vote in juries. And without those people, literature wouldn't exist. And sometimes they're good writers, of course, as well. But William really did participate and was really such a lively part of that scene, and also very helpful to young writers. If they wrote to him, he would do lessons with them. He was part of a community, and that's not nothing either.
No, it's true.
So thank you so much. I think that's the end of the... conversation.
Thank you, Sadie. It was a pleasure reading you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Du har lyssnat på en podcast från Aftonbladet. Ansvarig utgivare är Lena K. Samuelsson.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com